Welcome to World of DAS, a show for data enthusiasts. I'm your host, Oren Hoffman, CEO of Safegraph and GP of Flex Capital. For more conversations, videos, and transcripts, visit safegraph.com/podcasts. Hello, fellow data nerds. My guest today is Ben Horowitz. Ben is the co-founder of Andreessen Horowitz, one of the most influential venture capital firms in Silicon Valley. Prior to his VC career, he founded Opsware/LoudCloud, which was acquired by Hewlett-Packard for $1.6 billion. Ben's also the author of the best-selling book, Hard Thing About Hard Things, which is personally one of my top three favorite business books. And also, What You Do Is Who You Are. Ben, welcome to World of DAS.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Art.
Yeah, I'm really excited. We've been talking a lot about AI, and you guys are famous for the fact that software is going to eat the world. Do you think AI is going to eat the world the way software did, or in a slightly different way?
Probably in a little different way. In a way, it's a continuation of software eats the world, and in a way, it's different in that when we talk about software historically, we've had this deterministic, very factual, very literal software. And with AI, we have this probabilistic, non-deterministic software. And so one, you can solve a whole class of problems that we could never touch with traditional software, but also the nature of it is quite a bit different than traditional software in the way it does things and potentially makes mistakes and whatnot.
This is like a fundamentally new moment, or you disagree?
Oh, I think so. I think it's a fundamentally new moment. We're going after a class of things that we could never go after before. So that makes it, it's almost like, oh, we have a microprocessor. It's that level of change.
The narrative is that AI will be some heavy advantages to these large incumbent players who have lots of data, who can build these very huge models and afford these massive compute costs. Do you buy that narrative?
I think that it's a little bit TBD. So I think on the current course and speed, that's been where it's been going in the sense that basically the algorithm change advantages, particularly for LLMs, haven't seemed to be as significant as just bigger models. However, I think that it's really early on and we don't know how far the scaling goes, both the data side and the compute side. And we don't know what the open source real counterattack is yet. So I think Meta shocked the world and changed the landscape by putting out Llama. And Llama's really good. And one could imagine if the whole world rallied around that and Meta found a partner or came up with a way to not only give out the open source, but to serve Llama. That could change things a lot on the big side. And then one of the things we're also seeing is just for certain kinds of tasks, you know, a lot of what businesses want to do, a large model can be for interpreting English or that writing code, there's no substitute for it. But for a lot of other kinds of tasks, you might want a smaller, faster, cheaper model. I think there's a lot to learn still.
A lot of this is based on just crawling the internet. And obviously, most sites are allow Google and Microsoft to crawl them, but many of them, most of the biggest ones, don't allow really anyone else. So these two companies have a bit of an advantage when it comes to just doing the crawl itself.
They have the data, which is one thing, and then they have the money to buy more data, buy proprietary data and so forth. So that's certainly definitely part of it, but one could imagine. The internet was like this, by the way, where I think if you go back to 94, almost nobody in the media thought that the internet would win, that the open version would win. Everybody thought that it would be controlled by a single company, probably Microsoft. And in fact, when Bill Gates wrote The Road Ahead, his big book about the
future, I don't think he even mentioned the internet really, right?
He didn't mention the internet in the first edition. So it wasn't a fait accompli that the internet would be open. And I don't think it's fait accompli yet that the large models are going to be proprietary. I think for the good of humanity, it would be nice if it wasn't proprietary. The thing that happened in the internet is in many ways, it wasn't as functional as Microsoft Network originally, but it was functional enough and then had the entire world working on it and contributing to it, whereas only Microsoft was contributing to MSN. Hopefully that'll happen and the world can defeat Google and OpenAI and some of these guys.
We're looking at ways to improve our workflows and try to hand them off to AIs. I'm really excited to have these agents working for me. How does that look like for either the average person or the average worker over the next decade?
It's a lot unpredictable.
What are you most excited about there?
Yeah, well, I think that everything that is no fun to do, you ought to be able to hand off to an AI. And this is everything from building your personal network to doing mundane tasks like figuring out how to order food and all these kinds of things or book a flight. Those are certainly coming down. I think it'll get, though, much more aggressive than that. And one could imagine if you take something simple like, okay, now to book a flight, I've got to pull down all these windows and this and that and the other. Just say, hey, I'm going to Paris. Can you get me there? I was talking to my friend Ariel, who's the CEO of Navan, which does travel stuff. And he said, why do you have to tell it you're going to Paris? It already knows that. Maybe you just have the most helpful friend in the world who can do anything, and they know you, and you just have conversations with it from time to time and give it access to your calendar and your email, and it just does its thing.
And even if you think of a UI path, you have to bring in like Accenture, you spend millions of dollars on it. So it really wasn't applicable to most work situations. You could see a scenario where we all have at least our own mini UI path for us.
I think so. And then every software tool you use, you probably need to completely rethink. We have all these salespeople using Salesforce, but Salesforce seems like the complete wrong idea for an AI world in that, why am I entering what I think happened in a call I made into a system and incomplete? And then I have to worry about my job too, and whether I'm going to get fired because my forecast isn't high enough and this and that. And then a manager looks at it and adjusts what I said. And then some other manager looks at what that manager did and adjusts what he said and all that kind of thing. Why not have the AI just track what I'm doing, the emails I sent, the contracts I exchange, the phone calls I make, the meetings I go to, and make the forecast for me based on real information.
And update it too. Updating the CRM is such a pain in the butt, especially Salesforce, because it's 17 clicks to enter one thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's literally technology. We used to call that a 4GL back in the 80s when I started my career. It's just completely absurd, but that's where it is. And so I guess my big assumption is that everything is going to change and in very, very unpredictable ways.
Some of the other big waves, the internet, the cloud, mobile, AI seems like something that is actually going to impact all of our lives. Crypto didn't really seem like it had the potential to help everyone. Maybe there's this idea of remittances or something, or am I underselling crypto?
I think you're underselling crypto. Crypto's run into this weird regulatory morass in the US due to, I would just say, a very weird specific agenda from the administration. But as a technology, the way I would think about it is the history of computing is the history of computers and networks, going back to microwaves and integrated circuits and all these things. And they evolve at different speeds and in different ways. And the value of the network is always harder to see than the value of the computer. Because the computer, it's just like, ask it a question, it tells you the answer. It's like very obvious, it's amazing. But with the internet, in the beginning, businesses were like, oh, the internet's nothing, we're not going to even use it. Maybe we'll build an intranet, but we're definitely not going out on the internet. And then Sun Microsystems banned the use of the internet for employees in, I think, 1995.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
With networks, because they're a network effect, it's really hard to see the importance until there's enough people on it where it's a critical mass. And I think with crypto, it solves all the problems we have had with networks since the internet, particularly the concentration of power over really important things like the truth. Companies control what's true now. And I think that that is probably the single most dystopian part of what's happened with social networking and how it combines with the government and so on. And so if you think about an AI world, figuring out what's true just got way harder. You have deep fakes that are going to be such high quality by the time, by the way, the election cycle hits, that it's going to be impossible for anybody to determine what's what. Really, the answer is if you or I say something, we ought to sign it and put it on the network. Do we want to sign it and put it on a public network that is controlled by nobody? And if we say it's true and came from us, that wins? Or do we want to have a single company decide what's true and have whatever political agenda or whatever political pressure they have to make that determination? And I think that the world with the crypto answer is such a better world than the world without it. So I think that technology is going to prove to be exceptionally important. Hopefully we can get out of our own way and Gary Gensler will stop harassing everybody about it.
What I hear you saying, though, is that maybe AI can be like crypto's savior. There's a better reason for crypto because there's a safety. And you would think with this administration, safety would be something they would maybe jump on.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, I think it is in some ways maybe the killer use case for the technology. And by the way, the current blockchain technology would already work brilliantly for that idea.
Okay, interesting.
So we don't even need to really enhance the infrastructure to make that happen.
Now, one of your most influential management concepts is this idea of a wartime versus peacetime CEO, and that there's these different leadership styles that are optimal in different times of crisis versus times of growth. I think we're now in a situation where there's all these amazing peacetime CEOs that find themselves operating in wartime. What's your advice to them to make that transition?
Yeah, so the way I would think about it is, imagine you've built an army to fight the Cold War against the Soviet Union, and you've profiled all the people you've hired to fit into that. You've created a management structure.
They all speak Russian.
They speak Russian. They understand that part of the world. You have goals and objectives and KPIs around that and so forth. And one day you wake up and you're fighting ISIS or fighting China. Probably all that apparatus that you set up is incorrect. So the way that you've been managing, let's look at our KPIs, isn't going to work. You have to quickly change the army in pretty radical ways. You probably have to change out a lot of your leadership. You've probably got to find a different soldier. Your KPIs are all irrelevant. And the only way to get from here to there, you can't recreate that whole apparatus that you've set up to fight that war. You've got to move faster than that. And that involves the CEO making very, very sharp, fast decisions and sometimes going low in the organization to make them so that people get the object lessons of, oh, no, we're setting up over here. Once you get the army to move, you can do that. A really great recent example of somebody not making the transition was the Silicon Valley Bank crisis, where you had Gary Becker who, okay, they did a dumb thing that sent them towards war, which is they bought a lot of long-dated treasury bill. It wasn't the dumbest mistake in the world, but it just turned out when interest rates went up that having a bunch of 30-year T-bills was going to make your balance sheet look really bad. And then the Financial Times article hit that pointed that out. And then at that point, the race was on. So what they needed to do to build confidence was they needed to turn their balance sheet upside right, which required whatever, $3 billion, not an unsolvable problem. But he stayed in peacetime. So the right way to do it was to switch to wartime. Okay, everything we thought about raising money, fuck that. That's no longer true. We know the playbook. Goldman Sachs ran it. We're calling Warren Buffett. We're going to give him the deal of a lifetime, warrants, a discount, coupon, whatever he needs. And he's going to get money in and he's going to scare off the short sellers. And then we're going to stop the run on equity. And there's never going to be a run on the bank. That was the right move. What he did the exact same thing that he would have done if he wasn't at war, which is, oh, I'll call my friends at General Atlantic. You never mind that they're having trouble raising their own fund or whatever. I'm going to give them a market deal. And so, of course, the deal never goes through. The run on the equity turns into a run on the bank, and that's the end of the company. And it was very fast. In his defense, that whole thing changed lightning quick. But I think that's generally the case for all these CEOs is everything changed overnight. And now they've got to get the company going in the other direction. And the problem that everybody faces at CEO when they're in that situation is even their own team doesn't understand what the hell is going on. There's one person who understands it, and you have a limited time to get the whole organization to understand it and make all the very almost absurd changes, if you think about it in the old world, to get you to the new place.
Is that even possible for a non-founder CEO to have the authority to even do that?
I think that it's very hard for a professional CEO to do that, because the problem is there's all these assumptions in a business, all these principles, culture, product ideas, so forth. And as founder, you made all those. And so you know which ones you can get rid of safely because they were just wrong. They were based on another idea. And then which ones you have to keep. If you're coming in from the outside, I don't know how you do that.
And do you even have the authority? Because you don't own enough of the company. You don't have the moral authority necessarily. You have the antibodies in the company that are going to rebel against you. You mentioned the Defense Department. I doubt a Secretary of Defense could do that.
I think it's a very hard thing. I'll give you a funny story on that. After I sold Opsware to HP, I got a call from a private equity firm. And they said, Ben, we want you to join us. Just like that. No interview, no nothing. Just a cold call. We want you to join the firm. And I said, well, why? And they said, well, because we think that the LoudCloud to Opsware turnaround was the greatest tech turnaround in the last 20 years. And I said, well, you are aware that I'm the one who fucked it up in the first place. Right?
I don't know if somebody else. Maybe easier to fix your own mistakes.
For sure.
Now, a lot of what you cover and the hard things about hard things is about dealing with some of the toughest things that CEO face, layoffs, firing people, surviving downturns. You're now in your moment in the last couple of years.
Yeah, this is my time.
Bring back Ben.
Yeah.
What's your broad advice to CEOs at this time?
I'm relevant again. I like the best for CEOs right now is from Al Davis, who used to own the Raiders before he passed away. And he used to say this thing, I'd rather be right than consistent. I think that's the key. The need to hang on to consistency, to make whatever you said before is true, is the thing that will kill you right now.
It's hard to disagree with yourself. Maybe from yourself 20 years ago, it's one thing, but yourself from 1 year ago, it's much more difficult.
2 months ago.
Or 2 months ago, especially if you've written 10 blogs and all these internal memos about it and you've tweeted about it. And now all of a sudden you're like, I'm that guy who looks like me and has the same name as me is completely wrong. How does one get the fortitude to do that?
It's a measure of humility that you're okay with people. One, realizing that you're wrong, and then the confidence to continue to be the leader. Because if you were wrong before, why should we believe you now? That's the fear. Hilariously, when I was running LoudCloud, I said at some point, Opsware will never be on a CD, because that's how we deliver software in the old days. And as soon as we split off Opsware and made that the company, every engineer was like, quoting me on that and so forth. got that one wrong.
Sorry, I was wrong.
What you have to be willing to say is, look, the facts changed, so I've got to change my opinion. You have to deal with reality. Why me? Well, I now have more experience in this market and with this technology than anybody, and so I've learned a lot. The old me wasn't as good as the new me, and that's why the new me is changing that decision the old me made. And that's the best you can do. But the worst thing is to try and stay with the old idea.
I really admire traders who had a view of the world. They made a trade, and for whatever reason, that view turned out to be wrong. And they unwind the trade, they take their loss, and they move on and do something else. I think it's a very special person who can do that consistently.
That is true. Look, it requires that you don't attach your success to you personally. Your success is a result of the things you do and the decisions you make. And just because it's you doesn't mean that's always going to be correct. You can make a lot of mistakes. And I would say that's the psychological error that people have great success early often make is that, oh, I did it. So, and it worked because I did it. And so the next thing I do is going to work. That's not at all how the world is.
Paul Graham has a saying, keep your identity small. But I think that's easier said than done.
Very much easy. Because look, everybody around you is pumping it into your head.
Now, I love the anecdote in Hard Things about Freaky Friday, where you basically swap two of your execs to running each other's functions. Have you ever actually seen that done since?
Actually, a lot of entrepreneurs have told me they've done it. So the key to it, which I don't know if I made it clear enough in the original post, is you have to have the skill set on both sides to swap it. So, you know, I swapped like the head of professional services and SEs for the head of support, and they both had the same skill set, so that worked fine. I think if you tried to swap the head of engineering with the head of HR, you'd have a real problem. The people who clash tend to be the people who think they can do the other person's job. So it does work in that sense.
Okay, got it. So there's the more people are alike, this is the Girardian thing, the more they clash or something like that.
Exactly, the Girardian thing. That's a great analogy.
Now, building a strong culture is a recurring theme in almost all your work. What's the biggest way that people do it right? I feel like there's lots of easy ways to say people do it wrong, but what's the way people do it right?
I got this from the samurai, which, by the way, samurai culture had a lot of issues in terms of what the culture actually was, but in terms of the consistency and the conformity to the culture was maybe the most amazing example in human history. And the thing that they really got right was a culture is not a set of beliefs. It's a set of actions. And I think that anybody who defines their culture in terms of beliefs, we do the right thing, we have integrity, blah, 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 blah.
Customer comes first or whatever.
That never works. It's what are the behaviors that you have to have here in order to stay here? That's the thing. What do you have to do? Which is why the name of the second book is What You Do Is Who You Are. What do you have to do to be in this culture? Not what do you have to believe? Because what do you have to believe? It's nothing.
Interesting.
What you tweet, what you say, what you blah, 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 nothing. How do you conduct yourself?
So this is why religions have these very, very odd rules, like you can't eat shellfish or something like that, because it's really about what you do.
Rules like that create a culture. Absolutely.
Okay. I never really thought about that. That's really interesting. Now, some questions on building a VC firm. I heard you say recently that compared to the rest of venture, Andreessen Horowitz is most similar to YC. Why do you make that comparison?
Well, I think we were most similar in that both of us were like, wow, the way VC works is weird in that it's all about them in that, okay, are we good at picking investments, da 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 da, but nothing about the product that they offer to entrepreneurs. And I think the breakthrough for both Andreessen Horowitz and YC was, oh, we're going to start with what does the entrepreneur get? And then we'll worry about deal picking second. And I think that has been the biggest change in VC over the last 15 years has been us and them saying, what is the offering? What is my product and is it competitive as opposed to just, am I really smart and everybody wants to be around me because I'm so fucking smart? Which is like, what just happens to work forever, yeah.
GPs don't scale. Most people don't even know who the CEO of YC is. It's amazing. VCs give startups advice to create a monopoly, build a differentiated product, do dilution to accelerate growth, have one CEO, eventually go public. Probably none of these things most VCs take. Why are they so different?
It goes back to what you said, which is scale. And if you look at venture capital historically, the market for software was just smaller and the market for VC was smaller. So there used to be a thing when we started Andreessen Horowitz that all the VCs said, which I think was correct at the time, was there are 15 companies a year that will get to 100 million in revenue and your job as a VC is to invest in as many of those 15 as you can. So that was the scope of the industry. And I think there's no way anybody would say that's true now. It's much closer to 150 or 200. And so now scale actually is interesting. And then all those things that you referred to are scale ideas, which is why, by the way, if you look at how our firm works, there is a CEO, that's me. There is dilution in that we have lots of capabilities to build a product and so forth. So we follow that model a bit more that we advise people on. But it didn't make sense for the traditional VC, like a Benchmark, to do that because they're chasing 15 deals. And so they never needed to scale. Six partners, $400 million, 15 deals. The whole thing was that math.
In some ways, I mean, both obviously can work.
Yeah. I think the current world is better suited towards us and the old world was better suited towards them. And that's just how it is. That's my opinion.
I mean, the scale of venture capital has changed massively over the last decade. I believe you guys are now at like $35 billion AUM or somewhere in that.
Something like that, yeah.
Which is just mind-boggling if you would have just thought about venture capital a couple decades ago or something. And the scope of what the firms are looking at doing has changed. You guys are expanding internationally. There's wealth management solutions. Sequoia's got a hedge fund. Do you see VC and financial services somewhat converging?
I think they're certainly getting much closer together. And the way we think about it, there's different kinds of things, and certain things are closer together than others. But the way we think about it is, look, if you're somebody who's wants to build a company, we want to be the best partner for you from the day you start doing that to the day you become a philanthropist. And we want to even help you with that. So all the way through your life cycle. And so what are all the financial services needed to accomplish that? It's a big set. Now, I think for us to not be on the builder side, to be on the optimize, like something Avista would do, that would be a bigger departure. But in terms of anything that the entrepreneur building a company needs, I think that's very much what people want from us.
It seems that you've been building these products that are essentially these services, service product offerings. But you can imagine if you just think of it slightly different, like an AngelList is actually often building, they maybe have some services, but they also have like a UI and they're actually building some products. Can you imagine a scenario where A16Z itself is building products or you acquire some of the firms you've invested in or something?
We'll probably have more of a software interface to what we do. I think that's very likely. I don't know. We're really equipped. We do have internal software with real engineers building things. They're mostly for our use for now.
Discover all the companies to look at or something like that. Or,
you know, I think our role is our role. We do have to be a little bit careful about that. And the last thing I would ever want to do is compete with a company we invested in. That would be ridiculous.
In the 2000s, I think we saw a couple of VCs go public. Do you think we'll see a scenario where VCs go public and maybe acquire other VCs?
The value of going public is you monetize or equitize the franchise itself. So you now have another way to compensate people and all those kinds of things that go with having the actual firm be worth something. And you've seen a little, I think, Thrive just sold a piece of the GP and be valued at a certain level and all that thing. So.
And obviously you have, from the management fees, you have revenue streams and stuff.
Yeah, you've got revenue streams and then you've got the investing income and all that. I think the challenge for a VC going public, though, is if you look at how, say, Apollo is valued or BlackRock is valued or the similarly structured things.
Or even like a KKR or something.
Yeah, KKR. Wall Street values the fee stream much higher than the investment returns. And I think that's a dangerous incentive set for a VC. If all you were doing was venture capital and you were massively incentivized to get more fees and not incentivized to get more returns.
It's just an AUM game.
Yeah, that's probably not going to end well in venture capital. However, if a firm expanded, if you look at Apollo, people think of them as a private equity firm. But their other businesses are actually way larger than the private equity business. It's not that big a problem for them the way Wall Street values them because they've got insurance companies and lending companies and all this kind of thing where fee streams actually are a fine incentive. And so I think for us in our current configuration or for the current competitive set, it doesn't make any sense. But one could imagine like VC evolving into something where that made sense.
If you think of a big bank or something like that, there's the investment bank side, and that would be very hard to go public on its own because they could have one quarter where they have this massive deal. They could probably have three quarters where they get nothing or something. But then it's married with all these other products that they have, which are much more consistent. You could see a scenario.
The original JP Morgan was a VC. That's what they did. They financed railroads and this and that, the other. And then it was equity investing. They got the equity on a deal-by-deal basis, or they got the money, they phrased it deal-by-deal as opposed to fund-by-fund. but they were VCs. And then that evolved into them being what we now know as JP Morgan Chase, the Colossus that it is. So yeah, you could imagine a VC like flipping into that again. It's a little harder to become JP Morgan Chase these days because the original one achieved quite an amazing degree of regulatory capture, as we've seen. The big banks, we had this huge too big to fail legislation in following the 2008 crisis. Since then, every big bank has gotten bigger. And no new banks have been formed. So it had the exact opposite effect that was intended.
There's these companies who are slightly on the side of venture that I think over time could play a very big role. There's AngelList, there's Carta, which is an A16Z company. How do you see these companies interacting in the world? And they could have potentially a lot of power that they could leverage in discovery, in transactions, and secondaries, and all these other things that haven't yet happened.
This is also this weird question of the way the private markets work. So currently you have the public markets, which are massively regulated to the point where every public company has been sued. And then the number of public companies, I think, is half what it was 20 years ago in the US, because it's just so onerous to go public. And then you have the private markets, which are, I don't want to say they're not unregulated, but very light regulation and almost no enforcement. So you've got closely held companies and this and that.
You guys yourself only recently became an RIA, and I presume it's because of the crypto stuff you're doing.
That's exactly right. Crypto stuff and just the ability to do whatever we want with our public stuff and this kind of thing. But it's a weird dichotomy. And I think that what's happening now is because of that bipolar world we live in, people are building, reconstructing the entire public markets infrastructure in the private markets, which is, I think, good, but it's a little hard to see where it goes because it's just so weird. I think we've overregulated the public markets quite a bit. And then it just creates this not so smooth path to going public, which has also had the really unfortunate side effect of really that plus easy money exacerbating the wealth gap, because rich people buy stocks and companies, you know, in the private markets, and they own them and they have all this stuff and they have houses and this and that and the other. And so we massively increase the money supply and all these kinds of things, and assets go way up in value and people holding cash lose lots of money. We have very high inflation now and all that kind of thing. And so then the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. And I think the lack of access to new high growth companies in public markets is certainly a large factor in that process.
One of the things that's happened in the venture capital firms is this rise of these solo GPs that have happened. What do you think of that?
I think the big thing is, was that a boom market phenomenon or is it a lasting thing? So what happens in the boom market, and every entrepreneur, it's just, you have to be a positive person to be an entrepreneur. So if you're only thinking about what will go right, which is all anybody thinks about in a boom market, then, oh, there's one person who put money into the company and they've got 30 other companies and that's all fine. I just need the money. Like, I don't need any fucking help. Or I was one of the first three and I'm talking to the guy or this and that. In a market like this, I think it's harder to be a solo entrepreneur because you don't have any money coming in, or you have a lot less money coming in. And then for the entrepreneurs, they're like, okay, I need somebody who's going to actually help me when things go wrong. How do I do a layoff? Can you help me place my people? Can you help me sell the company? All the kinds of things that you actually need a financial partner to help with. They can't possibly do that. They're a solo. They're literally a solo entrepreneur. And so I think the idea is built for good weather, but that remains to be seen. Maybe it continues to work. The solo VCs that we work with, many of them are really good and we like working with them and they're a good complement to us. So they certainly have no problem with it, but I think the sheer number of them will probably shrink down to the best of the best in a market like this.
In the world of CEO handoff, we've seen that recently in Amazon, with Google, with Apple, with Microsoft, all seem like they went really well. And one of the reasons I admire Sequoia and YC is they've executed multiple CEO handoffs. How do you think about that from your context? How do you design a company, if you think of A16Z as a company, where one can actually do a handoff?
So I think Google and Microsoft and Amazon are a little misleading in that they're monopoly businesses.
Because the founder's still there too?
Well, the founder's around, but if you're a monopoly, the really difficult thing to do if you're the successor CEO is get to the new product. Can you innovate? There's a lot of people who can take over and run the thing that Jeff Bezos built. I think Andy Jassy and Satya and Sundar are all great, but that's a smaller test to take over the monopoly business and get the money out and do the thing and deal with the regulators and what you do in that. Then I think the Sequoia example was a harder example because they had to navigate across technological changes. So if you're in the VC business, probably the trickiest thing is, okay, we were great at social mobile. There's nothing to invest in that anymore. Are you going to be great at AI and do you have the right talent and did you turn over the right people and do you build the right capabilities to compete in that market? And that's something that you have to be really good to do. That's a much more difficult thing than just taking over and continuing to invest in social mobile. In companies, I think it's even more difficult. Like if you have a company that you're trying to transition to a professional CEO and then that CEO has to innovate. I think we're starting to see that with Snowflake right now, where Frank Slootman's probably the greatest professional CEO ever in enterprise.
He's incredible, yeah.
But now that they really do need to get new products and they're seriously challenged by Databricks, it's tough. That's not his skill set. So it's different, I think, in different scenarios.
It's the 0 to 1 versus the 1 to N type of thing.
Yeah, exactly. 0 to 1 is... there are very few people who haven't done 0 to 1 that can do 0 to 1. Like that's a very special skill. And then it's actually in some ways harder when the company is bigger because the resistance that you get is fairly remarkable.
Well, you've been involved in tech for a long time, over 30 years. What are the most important things that have been true the whole time?
Probably the product really has got to be a breakthrough to create a company. And right now we're seeing a lot of this where people are going to the obvious idea. So, okay, AI is here. Let me build something that helps you edit your documents on top of one of the large models that somebody's built. Of course, somebody's going to do that, but there's probably going to be 80 people who do that. And it's very hard to run into a space that's that competitive and so forth. It's not really a breakthrough idea. It's just a simple application of a breakthrough technology that somebody else made. And I think those have always been tough to get a company out of that. Although you might get you enough capital and enough customers to be in position to create a breakthrough. And then you can do that. But that I think has been true probably the entire time.
Just to push back on that, it does seem like a lot of these companies that win, they're the second, third, fourth mover. They've got a product that's pretty similar, maybe like a slightly better UI, a better sales model, maybe they're better operating at it, and they seem to win. They just move faster than the other, see what's working, and they iterate on it. Or you don't agree? You think they're having real innovations?
It's a little bit how you interpret the history. The most famous of this was MySpace, Facebook. But I think when you get into the MySpace product, it was pretty different product than Facebook. The network effects got into competition, but architecturally, they took radically different approaches. And I think that the Facebook people would always say, okay, execution is all that matters and da 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 da. I'm not so sure about that. As we witnessed from the Threads Twitter contest that recently came out, I think Threads from a software perspective was an awfully good competitor, but the network effect was baked at that point. And like,
but sometimes the innovation is very slight. The DoorDash innovation, it's these very, very slight innovations. As an investor, how do you even know that's an innovation as opposed to, oh, this is a good operator going after a good market?
I think that's really hard to tell. I think that you have to start with the entrepreneur. Is this an entrepreneur who you really want to back because you think that they wouldn't even be doing it if it wasn't way harder than it looked? This was also the case with Dropbox. Dropbox didn't look really like a breakthrough in a lot of ways in that It was a very simple idea. There were many other people doing variations of the theme. But I think that with Drew, he was really an unbelievable engineer himself. And he had dug into that problem and knew what was hard about it. What was hard about making that experience great. And that was what he did. That was their contribution.
I remember the first time I used Dropbox, it was amazing. I was doing this with a hacky thing I used with SVN, trying to do this myself, and it was terrible. And then all of a sudden, this came out, and it was almost free. It was amazing. Like, I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's like a sigh of relief. But just looking at it from a market map standpoint, it would have been very confusing.
Okay, that's fair. Now, a couple of personal questions. Your dad is a conservative pundit. You're probably more on the center left. How has his intellectual journey taught you about public discourse, about civility, life in general?
Well, it's taught me how misinterpreted everybody is, particularly when you get into politics. It's so tribal and so weird. And actually, I give you a couple of stories. So there was a story that was done on my father and me in the New York Times a while back. And it was probably something I should have never done because being associated with my father is super dangerous for me. It was David Streitfeld, who, by the way, did a very honest job of that piece. But the very first question he asked me, he said, sits in my office and he goes, "Ben, your father said Black Lives Matter is a criminal organization. What do you think of that?" That was his first question. And so I'm like, okay, so do you want me to attack my father? What do you want here? And I said, "Well, why are you asking me that question?" And he goes, "What do you mean, why am I asking you that question?" I was like, "Well, you're asking me. That's very specifically directed at me, probably because you're like, Ben, you're very involved with the Black community. How do you feel about your father saying something like that?" And he goes, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Well, have you ever thought about why am I so involved in the Black community?" I said, "Might it be because when I was 5 years old, my father took me to the Black Panther Church every Sunday, Son of Man Temple, and I know all the fucking words to all the songs, and I drink cognac now because that's what all the Panthers drink, and it's stuck in my fucking head. Before you assume that that guy said that because of some racist thing, maybe you ought to consider the whole picture that you're in." And then I went on to explain it. And to his credit, he adjusted his narrative on the story and all that kind of thing. But those are the things that come up. But politics gets really stupid when it comes to relationships and judgments and all these kinds of things. And people think, "Oh, that person's evil and that person's evil because they had that opinion on this thing that I disagree with." It's a lot of people misinterpreting each other. And of course, it's much easier to do in 140 characters.
One of the things in politics is that everyone has this public persona in politics, and maybe this is true in general, but certainly in politics. And then in some ways, they need to play into that public persona and really need to live it up. And then when you meet these people in real life and you actually have dinner with them or you have a relationship with this person, you realize they're really not like their public persona.
Well, yeah, it's shocking, isn't it? I remember the first time I met Karl Rove, my jaw was on the floor the entire conversation. I was talking to that Karl Rove, and he was saying these things. It just didn't make any sense to me.
I find that very interesting as well.
Yeah, that's all politics, yeah.
One question we like to ask is, what is a conspiracy theory that you believe?
Okay, so I 100% believe that COVID started in the Wuhan lab, escaped the lab accidentally.
Like on someone's shoe or something?
Yeah, however it happened. They disappeared all the people in the lab. That's the first clue. Why did all the scientists disappear? That lab and that research was funded by the US government, the Gates Foundation, all the people ID'd by the conspiracy theorists. That all turned out to be true, as I've read it in detail. Maybe that one's not that controversial anymore.
Now saying that, that's not a cancelable thing to say. Maybe a lot of people may or may not agree with you, but it's certainly not cancelable today. Whereas 2 years ago, if you said that, that would be an immediate cancelable statement. Why was that so cancelable when we were in peak COVID?
Well, so I think this is probably one of the most dangerous things going on in America. So my interpretation of what happened is Trump, he did a lot of things, but one thing that really stayed with us is everybody on the left, everybody on the other side who was an anti-Trump felt that anything was justified if it was against Trump or against something he said. So when Trump called it the Kung Flu or all the kinds of things he said, then everybody on the left had to take the exact opposite view. That was racist. He should never have said that. By the way, the Kung Flu probably is a little over the top on the racism thing, but the fact that it came out of China, the fact that it could have been man-made, all that stuff. And of course, and then they went on to the recent things that have come out from the CIA, where there's a whistleblower that said they actually paid us to lie about the origin story. And then the censorship, the very aggressive and what's turned out to be illegal censorship of all the social media companies from the US government, from the FBI, was all justified. So why are crimes committed? Well, because the people believe they're not crimes.
Or it's the greater good. It's the ends justify the means type of thing.
Yeah. A good crime, a good person. And the validation that I was a good person is because I was on the other side of what Trump said. That politicization of COVID and the bled over into lockdown, how effective were lockdowns, how effective was masking, all these kinds of policy decisions were justified not on the science, stand 6 feet apart, not on any actual scientific rigor, but all based on a political idea that anything that was the opposite of Trump was the right thing to do. And we could go all the way to censoring people, paying people to lie, faking investigations, all that stuff was fine. And, you know, it's a really sad period, I think, in American history that it went like that.
It seems like the cancelization of the Wuhan lab theory broke when Jon Stewart went on, because no one could accuse really Jon Stewart as being pro-Trump.
A right-wing shill.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously he's funny and he's hilarious as well. It was almost like the Nixon to China. Don't want to use the China analogy twice, but he could do it maybe, but nobody else. It's not like Fox News could do it or something.
I think that's exactly right. He cracked open the censorship and then the discussion was able to happen. And as soon as the discussion happened, everybody was like, oh, it did come out of the lab.
Hey, right. Then the New York Times could write a piece about it.
It wasn't a penguin.
Interesting. All right, last question we ask all of our guests. What conventional wisdom or advice do you think is generally bad advice?
There's much that's bad advice. Hire slow and fire fast. And let me explain why. The truth is, nobody who's not a psychopath fires fast. That's never how it works. Because you thought about it a lot when you brought the person on. You have a relationship with them. There's huge consequences to firing them. I've never spoken to any CEO who is like, I fired that person too fast, other than psychopaths who do that. For 99.9% of the CEOs, they never fire too fast. So when you say hire slow, what you're basically doing is giving them an excuse to not really focus on the recruiting process, the hiring process, being the correct amount of prepared to make a decision that hiring, particularly executives, is fraught with peril. Generally, half of them make it. So by hiring slow, all you're doing, if you take a year to bring in a candidate, that doesn't actually help you. That doesn't improve the quality. What improves the quality is do a good job of preparing, meet with enough people who understand what it means to be a CFO, what a great CFO looks like versus a mediocre CFO, and then interview candidates for what you need in your company, what they need to be world-class at, not some generic idea. Some guy who comes in wearing a suit, you think will talk good to Wall Street, that dumb stuff. You can do that slowly too. So it's hire correctly and then make the hard decision when you have to is actually the right advice. Hire slow, fire fast is generally advice given to people who have never hired executives, I find, or certainly never fired executives because they don't know. They just heard it. It sounds good. I'm passing it on. Every VC says that. It's a bunch of bullshit.
But for certain types of executives, for most entrepreneurs, hiring a head of engineering is something they could really dive into and do well, and certainly would do well in hiring a head of engineering, whereas hiring a CFO might be a much, much more difficult task. They may have never met a good CFO in their entire life.
Hiring a Japanese interpreter and you don't know Japanese.
Yeah.
they're all going to sound like they know Japanese.
Exactly. Yeah. And I guess that's where you use trusted advisors, but then sometimes you don't know how much to trust them for this particular thing, right? Or,
well, trusted advisors don't actually work because most executives fail not because they're not competent, but because they don't work in your organization.
Don't fit your culture.
What I need for right now, the CFO of General Motors is not going to get the job done, because what I need is somebody to put the basic control structure in place and this and that and the other. The right way to approach that is you have to learn enough about the job. And there's a variety of ways to do that. So one way is to just act, if you've got junior people on that team, act as CFO, just run the meeting, see what problems they're running into, understand the job so that you know something about it before you hire. Another thing you can do is say, okay, I just want to meet five CFOs that people consider good and ask them the right questions. What is the job of the CFO? What are the parts to it? What's the difference between a good CFO and a great CFO? Tell me some examples of how you would test that in an interview and build up a view of all the things that a CFO might be good at, and then say, well, what do I need in my company for them to be good at right now for the next 24 months? And then match that and look for that person, as opposed to trust somebody who knows a CFO from another company who did well in that context, but may not be at all relevant for you. That's the right advice on hiring executives, is the right kind of preparation, right kind of process. And then firing is a different event. You can hire slow and still fire slow, and you can hire the wrong person even if you go, takes you 2 years to find the guy. I've seen that many times. That's my piece of conventional wisdom that drives me crazy, because there's some truth in it, but it's not true.
This is amazing. Well, thank you, Ben Horowitz, for joining us on World of DAS. I follow you at BHorowitz on Twitter or X or whatever they call it. And I definitely encourage our listeners to engage with you there. This has been great.
All right. No, great to see you, Oren. That was fun.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, consider rating this podcast and leaving a review. For more World of DAS, and DAS is DAAS, you can subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere you get your podcasts. And also check out YouTube for videos. You can find me at Twitter at Oren, that's A-U-R-E-N, Oren, and we'd love to hear from you. World of DAS is brought to you by Safegraph. Safegraph is geospatial data for physical places. Check it out at safegraph.com. And by Flex Capital. Flex Capital invests in data companies like those we talk about at World of DAS. Check it out at flexcapital.com.